Please listen carefully.
And now, live from a commandeered radio tower in Nunya Business, Texas, it's the Assuming Positions Podcast, featuring two guys stuck in the back half of a two-person horse costume, Kevin and Mikey.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Assuming Positions Podcast. Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
And today on the podcast, we're assuming the return of Miyazaki.
Hey, I'm Miyazaki. Oh, I'm so glad it happened.
10 years after retirement, he comes out of retirement to do one last job.
Yeah, apparently a project that was 7 years in the making. Yes. So
the new Studio Ghibli film called The Boy and the Heron, or...
How do you live?
How do you live in Japan? Let's see if I can do it. Kimitachi wa do ikuru ka.
Good enough for me?
Sure. I have no idea.
You made somebody cringe, but we, you know, we can't see them.
Like Dave Thomas trying to say muchas gracias over here.
The old Chipotle commercial. Chipotle. No, but this is Miyazaki, like you said, his final film. This is officially, as far as everybody seems to say, this is his swan song. Isn't that what you call it? Your final opus?
Yes.
But for Miyazaki.
The curtain call, the bow. This was an encore. This was came back after.
That's true.
He left. It's like, thank you. Thank you. Good night.
And it absolutely is an encore because he psyched everybody out. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm done. Just getting them back. It's like, oh, they got two more songs.
Yay.
Absolutely. Miyazaki encore. I love it.
So this, we just saw it. I just saw it. Mikey just saw it.
It just came out.
We haven't had tons of time to think about it. And this movie needs a lot of thinking about, I feel.
Fair enough.
Well, first of all, this movie is absolutely, positively beautiful.
Yes.
It is a moving piece of art in every sense of the word.
As we've come to expect with Studio Ghibli, and like, I wasn't even thinking of the actual like visualness of it going into it, you know, as far as expectations go. Because I was just like, oh yeah, you know, I know what I'm getting. I've seen Howl's Moving Castle. I've seen Spirited Away. Uh-huh. I've seen Princess Mononoke. All beautiful.
Yes.
And you don't really know how much they level up until you get to the new one.
Yeah.
And then we got to the new one and the opening scenes, because the backdrop for this movie is war.
Yes.
So the opening scenes are very war-driven.
Yes.
And it's beautiful. Like, there's a lot of flames and heat involved, that's incorporated into the art. And it's just, you realize how much they level up.
Yeah, it was crazy. That whole first opening scene, the movie basically deals with this boy named Mojito. Or Mojito? Mojito's a drink, isn't it?
Mojito.
Sometimes I'd be like, Mojito, why do I want a rum and lime drink right now with mint in it?
Because he's walking around in the woods.
But... Mojito is a boy who lives in Japan during World War II, and it starts with the sirens going off, and they're being bombed, and everything's on fire, and it is dynamic and fluid and striking right from the jump.
Yep.
It hits you right in the face.
That's it.
I would say.
Yeah, and it lets you know, I mean, this is an after-the-fact sort of realization, but it lets you know that you're getting into something a little bit weird.
Yes.
Because the art style, like I was saying, I noticed it with the heat lines.
Yes.
So he starts running, and I love how Miyazaki does running people, because it's always way more energetic than it needs to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when it's in a situation like, oh, there's air raid sirens going off, and there's panic, and people are evacuating, you know, it's that kind of running energy.
Yes.
And it's just conveyed in one staircase. But for the flames and the heat that are going on, because it looks like the village got either attacked or bombed.
Yeah.
It does the heat wave effect, so everything sort of gets like wavy and distorted.
Yeah.
But it becomes painterly and artistic.
Right.
And it almost makes the whole sequence seem sort of dreamlike, because we're from the point of view of a little boy.
Yeah.
You know, and so it sets that up really early, and it does a great job of it.
Yeah, it's impressionistic almost.
For sure.
And it reminded me of like those kind of the German impressionists, where it's beautiful and horrible at the same time.
Very much so.
It gave me that kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like, oh, this is beautiful, but it's like his mother is burning to death.
Exactly.
In a hospital fire.
That's it.
And, oh, man. So it has that. I want to say this. There's no frivolity in this movie, really, I don't think. As far as, like, everything seems that is being done for a reason.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a meaning behind everything.
And this is the,
conscious decisions are being made.
For as dreamlike as this movie is, it is also the most grounded and the most real compared to, like, your Princess Mononoke's or Howl's Moving Castle. This is, like, for the most part, this is a slice of life story of a family that during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But... yeah, you don't even get really what's going on, that, you know, that it's the mom and all that. It's this, so, like, it's from the childhood point of view of it's chaos and energy, and it's, you don't know what's going on. But absolutely, it's like those old paintings where even if it's just a landscape, there's a little bit, it still conveys an emotion,
right,
or a depth to it, and you're like, wait, there's something else going on here, even though everything seems relatively normal.
And the whole movie, I don't know if you felt this, but it slowly kind of unfurls and takes you into the, it gets more and more fantastical, but it's very fed to you very slowly.
Yep.
Initially I thought, I was like, get on with it. This movie was kind of slow paced.
Very much so.
And I was almost being like, what is going on here? But once you get to the end, you know, it's the journey, not the destination, Mikey.
Such is life. How do you live?
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's, if you stick with it, I guess, is what I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
You get the reward at the end. But it does, like, the first act is really slow. And it's just, they leave. I think they might have been in Tokyo. They're in one of the major cities.
Yes.
But they had to leave. His father, this boy, I'm going to tell you, there are three characters in this that are Miyazaki, I believe. And the first one is this boy, because he's 84, I think. He was a boy during World War II, and has memories of blown up cities, and his father worked in the airplane defense industry. And this Mahito's is the same way. His father works in the airplane defense industry.
Yeah.
They move out to the country because the factory was moved out there, because that's what the Japanese start doing, because they just start spreading everything around, because it's hard to bomb stuff if it's spread all over the place.
Yep.
That's World War II Kevin, you know, history guy over here. And so they move out to the country where this new factory is, and it also happens to be it was probably his decision to put it there, because this is where his aunt lives, his mother's sister,
who's
died in this fire. And in, I guess, I don't know if this is a Japanese tradition. I know it exists in, like, the Christian Bible, that you often marry your sibling's, like, spouse when their spouse dies.
I would say, like, yes, that probably is a Japanese traditional thing, but it is also of the time thing. Like, that was a weird sort of marital institution that was a thing. Like, to keep family and ties together, it was almost like a royalty thing where the next in line stepped up to fulfill the duty.
So his dad literally marries his aunt.
Yeah.
So, and she's like, I'm your mother now. And he's like, no, you're my aunt.
And they don't tell you this. That nothing, like,
no,
you said,
nothing is, like, it's broadcast.
It's all piecemeal.
Right.
Like, the plot points is really all we've described so far. It's during World War II, a family goes out to the country, and then, you know, to relocate while things are going bad, and then once things get better, they go back to Tokyo.
Like, I don't think it's, like, revealed that it's his aunt until, like, midway through the movie. Like, originally, it's just, he's like, oh, she looks so much like my mother.
Yeah, that's it.
Is all that's said, and you're like, okay.
The only other hint is that when she wakes up from a dream, she says, I'm sorry that I failed you, big sister.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But she's talking to Mahito, and you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And then you go, oh, wait, she's talking about big sister, which is her sister, which she's looking at Mahito. It must be his mom.
Yeah.
And that's, like, the end of Act Two.
Right.
Is when she lets that slip, and you're like, wait a second. And then you don't get confirmation of it until, Act Three.
Yeah. I think that this is a second watch movie. I want to see it a second time.
Yep.
because it is so visually striking. It's so beautiful.
Yes.
That I would say I spent a good half of the movie just overwhelmed in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Just taking it in. Yeah.
There was like, plus seeing it on the big screen, and it was just, it just washed over you. In a lot of ways, I think throughout this whole thing, this is just Miyazaki just throwing it all out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it had reference, not, I wouldn't call it references.
Yeah.
Like how we think of references. But I don't know how you would describe it.
I've been thinking about this so much. So here's how I come to it. If yeah. I think you're talking about it the same
let's
way.
See what,
so,
let's see.
This trope I know comes, I first saw it in Shakespeare in Love.
Okay.
And then I saw it in Finding Neverland. Okay. And then another movie called Saving Mr. Banks.
Okay.
And what those all movies have in common, and they're all about like the creator, they're all about like when Shakespeare started creating his plays.
Right.
And it sort of does like the dramatization of his life around that time.
Right.
Or Finding Neverland is J.M. Barrie writing Peter Pan. Right. Saving Mr. Banks is Walt Disney writing Peter Pan.
Right. The man who created Christmas.
Yeah, exactly.
About Dickens writing A Christmas Carol, I believe.
So in those, they like to do this joke where it's like, here's this real life event that happened, but it's also, you can tell that it's a hint of the inspiration for the creation you know them for.
Like
the old man smoking the cigarette, the groundskeeper in this movie is the soot, boiler maker guy, the boiler room guy from Spirited Away.
Right.
With only two arms.
Right.
But you can tell, like, if Mahito is Miyazaki, which we're led to believe.
Yes.
This is him telling his story in the fantastical childhood way that he remembers it.
Right.
That old man, oh yeah, that's why the character is in Spirited Away, because that old man was around when he was a little boy.
Right.
The old ladies, you know, right. are the, every witch we've seen.
Yes, everyone.
We've talked about that old lady in the Miyazaki movie.
Yeah.
We get seven of them. Not only is it Seven Dwarfs fairy tale.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's also like an overabundance of, oh, that's why Miyazaki loves old, like,
right,
and cranky, crotchety, but lovely old women.
And I saw that as a nod to Disney, because he's often said that Disney was like one of his inspirations. It's the Seven Dwarfs. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was the movie that made Disney as a studio.
That's it.
So you have seven. I counted them too. I was like, is there seven of them? Yeah. I think there's seven of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when he shows up in the dream version, or the, I don't know what we're going to refer to it as, but he goes into dreamscape.
Right.
But he has a caretaker there, and then the old ladies become statues because they're sort of totems of representing each other.
Yeah.
But I was counting them then too. I was like, wait, there's only six. Where's the seventh? And then I realized, oh, she went with him. So like,
yeah,
they're keeping track of it. But yeah, I couldn't help but think of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, because it's like princess of the fortress.
Right.
There are seven little helpers in this magical little, and it's just the countryside cottage, you know, but to a kid, that's magical.
And you could feel Arrietty in there, boy who has to go to the country.
Yep.
You could feel Spirited Away in there, the whole other realm, whatever we want to call it, whether you called it the dreamscape. I almost saw it as like a purgatory of some sort.
Yep.
And that's all. There's so much Spirited Away feeling in there. There's Howl's Moving Castle with the war and the violence and
the war of creatures that are unseen to the normal world.
Exactly.
In this tower. Yeah.
There's it's almost like he's referencing himself.
That's it.
Yeah.
And like, I love it for that. Like I caught on to that, and I think, you know,
it's like a victory lap.
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways.
And it's like, It does seem like, I mean, going into it, we knew that, you know, this is marketed as the final Miyazaki. Mm-hmm. So I guess you go into that with the expectation of that, or like having those glasses on. But I kept like, you know, what is he trying to say with this? Mm-hmm. What's sort of my mindset watching this? And you get to see that. It's like, here's why I am here's why I create the things that I create.
Right.
You know, because I had this, believe it or not, you know, it's up to you, but I had this story happened to me as a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's how I remember it. But memory is a funny thing, so it's not exactly historically accurate, you know? But it's got some elements in it, and you're like, oh, that's a Miyazaki. Like, you love it because you're like, oh, that's totally Miyazaki.
Yeah, it's almost concentrated Miyazaki.
Absolutely.
Which I think is, this movie has been critically acclaimed.
Yep.
Everyone seems to love it. Mm-hmm. There's a few people out there who don't like it because they don't get it, which is fine if you don't get it. Because, like I said, this is concentrated Miyazaki, in that Miyazaki has these, in all of his movies, it's there. There's a fantastical, there's an underlying point he's trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
Everything means something. He's very much an artist, as in the way that I think of artists, where they are pouring their emotions out into their art. They want to say something. They want it to mean something. Some people call that pretentious. Some people don't understand it. But he is one of those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a very modern version of it. And he puts all that into his art. And this one is just him just jamming it in there so much. It's Miyazaki doing what Miyazaki does without any filters. So if any of that weirdness from Spirited Away or Howls or any of his movies, if any of the weirdness puts you off,
mm-hmm.
I can see why watching this movie would just be like, oh my, it's so weird.
I got it.
And it is so weird, but it's almost wonderfully weird.
I'll double down and say, yes, wonderfully weird, because I'm fortunate that I had the circumstances, but I really lucked in with how I set myself up going into this movie, because uh-huh. we got hyped for it. We talked about it on Nerd Alerts.
Yeah,
it was like,
yeah.
Hell yeah, more Miyazaki. That was great. And we talked about who was going to be voices in it a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, like, we didn't know many details, so that was sort of the end of that.
That was on purpose by him.
Yeah, yeah. Too. And so, like, their minimalist approach or whatever.
He didn't even want the trailer. There was no trailers in Japan. There was only the poster. And he didn't want the trailers done in the United States, and they kind of were like, we have to do trailers in the United States.
I missed it if they did, and yeah. I think, because that's intentional, I say kudos to them, because I was expecting a more slice of life, just ordinary movie.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't expecting as much supernatural as we got, as mm-hmm. mystical as we got, and it was delightful is the perfect word for it, because every time something new happened, I was like, oh, we're getting this now? Oh, we're getting more of this now? It was awesome. It kept leveling up for me.
And that's the thing. Like I said, he slowly builds you to it. It's slowly like, it's like, well, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, this is getting even weirder. And then it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder.
But it's Miyazaki weird, and yeah. if you're a fan, then he's rewarding you, because
yeah.
he did, like, this is My Neighbor Totoro in parts, and that, like,
right.
So Mahito's at the cottage, and he sees a little dark circle entryway into the forest. He's like, of course somebody's going to go in there.
Right.
And of course it's a magical portal into not quite the forest.
Right.
And you just wait for it to happen. And it does. And yeah.
Yeah, there's that hole in the forest, and his aunt goes in. I'm not 100% sure why his aunt went in there.
His new mom.
Yeah.
She's having a hard time. Like, this is getting into, I guess, would be the most speculation of the synopsis, because I don't think this is as laid out as
no
the things we kind of know are. But I think she's having a difficult pregnancy.
Oh, okay.
Or I haven't tried. I'm
working. Well, yeah, she was, because she was bedridden. So she was having a difficult pregnancy. Yeah. Yes.
But that's never elaborated on.
Yeah.
And there is,
I kind of love how he doesn't tell anything.
No,
there's nothing told to you,
and even the concrete stuff is sort of like, yeah, but you know, unreliable narrator,
right.
So take that however you will,
right?
And then obviously, full spoilers, go watch this movie, but at the end, like, there is the whole time aspect. It's like him going back through the door is him going back to his real life,
right?
But there's also an aspect of his soul being born, and his mother's soul, his mother being born into life that she was supposed to leave.
Right.
With new mom being pregnant, I don't know if they're trying to say that's Mahito in a way and tie it in a weird way that way. Hmm. Like, I don't know if the pregnancy is like a third loop in the time travel.
Oh, you're getting really wibbly wobbly with it.
Which there's room for that.
Yeah, there's room for that.
But I really do think it's a new wife, stressed out by war, new child. In an environment, sister's dead. She got moved to the country. She's having a hard pregnancy.
Yeah. Okay, I understand that.
Yeah, but you never tell it, and like the closest we get is that,
and she knows about the tower too, mm-hmm. because she knows her sister went into the tower and disappeared for a year.
Yeah. Which
is crazy.
Yeah. So, and I said dreamscape, but there's, I mean, for what we're led to believe, things that happen in the dreamscape are tangible.
Right.
Like, it's not, they didn't happen because it was in a dream and you're out of the dream and everything resets.
Right.
No, like, it has effect on real world.
Yeah.
But only in some circumstances. So.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. I mean, we got this.
It's so weird.
And I hadn't, you know, I heard about, you told me about in Nerd Alerts, oh, there's going to be a talking heron.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had no idea it was like, you know, one of those.
Neither of us knew the heron was going to talk.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But it was, no, because you said Pattinson was doing the voice.
Oh, if I did, then I completely forgot by the time I watched this movie.
Okay.
Because that was the weirdest part, is when the heron starts talking and mutating, and you're just like, what is happening?
Right. It's so weird. And then I'm like, oh. And I can thank getting more into anime and thank Chainsaw Man for this, really.
Absolutely.
It's like one of those Japanese demon things. This is part of their lore and their mythology.
That's true.
And it is. I actually looked into it. The heron is associated with death, and it's almost the opposite of a stork. You know how the stork here would always bring life?
That's it.
The heron over there is like guides you into death in the spirit world, and that's the heron's kind of job.
That's sort of the conclusion, that's the assumption I came to.
Right.
That it was like a Japanese cultural thing.
Yeah, it seems to be, yes.
Or the second explanation is that this is letting the world know that Miyazaki hates birds.
Well, yeah.
Because that's the other explanation for part of this movie, is that birds are the bad guys, and they're scary as crap. No matter if they're parakeets or pelicans, like, birds are dinosaurs for a reason.
It's funny, he picked the least offensive bird, a parakeet, to be like the most offensive, scariest thing.
Those parakeets are amazing.
Yeah.
So that'll lead me into it, just the talking about the voice cast. So not only was Robert Pattinson as the heron amazing, I totally forgot that he was going to be in this.
Right.
Didn't realize it watching it. And then went and looked at, you know, sat in my car right after the movie and looked up the cast list. And I was like, what?
Yeah, I know.
He does a great job. But those parakeets are also, there's three dudes that get credit for it, for the English dub. And it's Mamoru Althi, Tony Rovellori, and Dan Stevens, which are random names that probably don't ring too many bells. But Tony Rovellori is Flash from all the Tom Holland Spider-Man.
Oh, okay.
So he was the voice of the parakeet, Flash. Dan Stevens is like a modern horror movie staple. Like, he's in horror movies. That's what he's known for. And Miyazaki has him playing a bird. And then Mamoru Althi, he's in a new series called Archive 81. That's a horror series. That's amazing. And he's great in it. But now he's showing up as a level. Like, I just going down that cast list, I was like, they got these kind of people to be voices for just almost side characters. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
We've had the conversation about, you know, big names being English voice actors in anime, but I don't know. I think Miyazaki still gets his pass for the people he put in here, because I didn't notice anybody, with the exception of Christian Bale, because you can always hear his lisp.
Yeah. But,
you know, that.
No, I mean, Florence Pugh is Kuriko.
No idea.
Seem like any Florence Pugh. And
I was fully convinced that the noble pelican, the dying pelican, fully convinced that was Patrick Stewart. I was like, oh, they brought him back.
No, it was Willem Dafoe.
Oh, no idea. I was like, it's Patrick Stewart.
There's some Willem Dafoe in there.
There you go.
But I didn't get in. I mean, even Mark Hamill as the granduncle, he was hitting it out of the park. He did a different voice. He's never done that voice before.
Not at all.
That was a new one.
Didn't even sound like old Luke.
Yeah. Didn't sound like old Luke. Didn't sound like the Joker or anything that he does.
But I'm glad that they kept the trope of both granduncle and Mahito. You can tell they are the main characters in this story because pointy hair.
Oh, yeah.
The only characters in the movie with pointy hair, and they are the main characters. Sorry, that made me giggle while I was watching it.
And as we said, it's obvious to most everyone that this is Miyazaki, kind of semi-autobiographical in a way. He's pulling from his own life. Mahito is him. It makes me wonder if there was ever a point in his life where he hurt himself so he didn't have to go to school anymore.
Yep, that's a weird crux in the movie.
Because it was weird and extreme, and Mahito's getting bullied at his new school, and on the walk home just decides, I'm just going to smack myself as hard as I can in the head with a rock, and we will show you all the bloods.
All the blood.
Yeah.
That is a moment where you're like, that's really specific.
I mean, it's really specific. It does pay out later
in
the movie to illustrate that he has the kind of evil in him or whatever it is they call it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm with you that it's definitely like probably inspired by
but it's very specific.
Yeah, by one of his life events. But the question to you, why do you think he hit himself in the head with a rock? Because they don't answer. That's another question that's to the audience. I mean, so I put it to you.
The easy answer is he didn't want to have to go back to that school anymore. And he knew that his dad would react in the way that he did.
Yeah, okay.
And that's the simple kid answer.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it has to do with, you know, my mom's dead and burned to death in this damn war. And he's not even really going to school. They just make them work in the field.
That's it.
And is it like...
And Mojito as a character is Mr. Sincere is what they joke about. Like, he's straightforward, no emotion, yeah. Like, do the job.
So is it an attempt to take himself out? Who knows?
It's such a shocking beat.
It's very shocking, yes.
That does fit and it narratively works, but it was captivating because I kept thinking about it because there are so many explanations for it. I'm with you in that, like, I do think it's the little boy thing of like, one, I don't want to go to school, but like, oh, if I do this, my dad will pay attention to me.
Right.
Because it's the, you know, dad's at war.
Yeah.
That sort of thing, because he has to be, because he's building awesome cockpit.
Yeah, that's what he built cockpits for the Zeros.
And the little detail in there, and the actual detail of like the drawing in there and the workers, it's fascinating and fantastic.
And the fact that this isn't explained, but being a World War II history guy, and maybe Japanese people would get this, is they put all those cockpits in his house on the estate.
Mm-hmm.
They ship them over there. And he said, because we can't keep them at the train station right now, which to me instantly said that they got intelligence that the train station is probably going to get bombed.
Or it has been.
By the Allies. Yeah. So we have to move these and hide them here. And that's they used to do that. That's Miyazaki being a kid, having gone to the country, knowing the kind of things that went on during the war, and he's giving you a little bit of that and not explaining it, but just being a history buff. And I was like, oh wow, that's totally something they would do.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just happens, and it also gives him the people to go looking when people go missing.
Yes. Absolutely.
So they're out there, and it's kind of, I mean, as the, you know, as vilified as the Japanese get in the war and being the antagonists in that in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
It's kind of nice to see them just portrayed as like, oh, someone's missing. We need to help find them.
Yes.
The humanity.
Absolutely.
There. Yeah.
It's one thing that it feels weird to say the phrase good war movie, but like, war is a terrible thing, and so you get when an artist takes a situation like war and tells a life story during it to sort of highlight certain points of it, and it's done really well, you get beautiful moments like that.
Yeah.
One thing that delighted me more when I watch it while I was watching this, because of my expectations again, is that I had no idea that this was going to be this lane of media, in that there is a sort of lane where it's fantastical events told from the childhood point of view.
Uh-huh.
Taika Waititi did it with Jojo Rabbit.
Right.
We've seen it. Empire of the Sun with Christian Bale and Steven Spielberg. Yep. But Miyazaki, actually, I'm glad I didn't read this till after the fact, but one of the books that he read that inspired him was by an Irish author named John Connolly.
Uh-huh.
And it's called The Book of Lost Things. And I read that tidbit and my jaw dropped because I love that book.
Oh, yeah?
And it's really just a boy's coming of age, but it is exactly this movie in the sense that it's a coming of age told from a childhood point of view, and it gets sort of fantastical.
Right.
Because a kid doesn't understand the world fully.
I would say Labyrinth, the movie Labyrinth, is that same way?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of Labyrinth in here. And I kept seeing little touches of it, but nothing that was like a rip it was awesome to see. He knows the formula, but we're getting the Miyazaki version of it.
Of the formula, yeah.
And something I realize that we're saying a lot here is they're not explaining it, or we don't get the answer to that. And that is a factor in this, but it never bugs me because of that setup. It's like, oh, we are the kid in this, so we're not going to get the answers because you're a kid, you don't know. And what you don't know, you sort of fill in the gaps, and sometimes it's not going to make sense, but it will connect eventually. But yeah. I do, like, I had no idea we were going to get this kind of movie, but this is instant button pushing for Mikey. It was like, oh, I love it. But yeah, and then him hitting his head, I still don't have the answer for it. But it comes up in the dreamscape again with is it the old lady that's the caretaker in the alternate world?
Yeah, Kiriko, the Florence Pugh character?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Because she has the cut, too. And that was a weird, like, just a beat where I was like, I think I know what's going on here, but I also have no idea what's going on here.
Yeah, because, you know, he goes into the tower, which he isn't supposed to go in the tower. Don't go in the tower. You shouldn't go in the tower. We told you not to go in the tower.
Yeah.
You can't tell a kid to do stuff like that. He's going to go in the tower.
And the next scene, it cuts to him lying awake on top of his sheets. Like, you can hear the clock ticking. And I was like, oh, he's totally sneaking out. Turns out he's waiting up for his dad. But it was just like, you know, that kid's going to the tower. Uh-huh.
But he had a good reason. He was looking for his aunt, mom aunt.
And and also the hilarious beat, because there are some comedy beats in this movie, is that he has beef with this heron. Like, he doesn't know what it is. I mean, the herons start talking, which makes it creepier. Yeah.
And
but
they're like, come with us.
Yeah.
And
your presence is requested.
The fish and the toads? What the heck is going on? Miyazaki, what are you smoking over there?
Oh, it's so wonderful. But yeah, the fact that he just has beef with his bird. He's like, I'm taking that heron out. There is something wrong with that bird. And it leads him deeper into the tower.
Yeah, He builds a bow and arrow, then realizes that he needs flight feathers.
And that's it.
And has some of the heron's feathers he picks up. And turns out that because the heron's not really a heron, he's a spirit or whatever he is.
Yeah.
He's
Birdman.
Yeah, they give it true flight.
Yeah, his flight feather number 6.
Yeah.
And they gave it a specific name. And that's part of the reason, like, I call this like a lane of media or a style of story, because that's such wonderful little kid logic.
It is little kid logic, yeah.
And I think in that still, and so I appreciate that. I still think in that way. It's magical thinking. I can't help it.
No, it is. It is. It's like when you're playing with your friend, and he's like, you missed me. He's like, no, I didn't. The arrow was made with flight feather number 6.
That,
like,
always goes left. Exactly. It's like, I've incapacitated you. What? How? I have light feather number 6. And you're like, oh, of course. Yeah. That's the stated reason. And it works because that's the rules in this world. Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, but speaking of bow and arrows, so the character I had the hardest time with, and I guess this is on purpose, is Natsuko, his new mom.
Yeah.
She is the weird interloper. So, like, it's presented that way. I guess I felt the character that way.
Mm-hmm.
But then she comes out early before she starts having a real hard time, and she shoots a flaming arrow to help save Mahito from a breakthrough of the dream world. You know,
yeah,
a blending between the fabric between the two worlds or whatever it is. And it, like, they don't explain it, but it's just her and the 7 little grandma dwarves following behind her. And it's like, oh, she's a warrior princess. And you get these little hints that she is just as strong as any other character in here. The father building munitions for the war. Mahito volunteering for everything that people ask him to. Mm-hmm. You know, being a tough child that's dealing with the situation of having to go through war.
Mm-hmm.
And then Natsuko, the dad's out of the picture, but she gets, you know, is sort of just the new mom character. Doesn't get much development except for in these little moments. And that flaming arrow is just like, holy crap, she's a warrior princess. It was a nice little detail.
And also, it kind of gives you a little hint that she knows what's going on with the tower.
Yep.
And, of course, the 7 dwarves also know what's going on the tower. She's almost the Snow White.
Absolutely.
Of the whole story. And I'm about to say you have to pay attention, but I don't think you do have to pay attention. All this stuff is given to you. It's digestible, but you don't figure it out until like hours later.
Oh,
this movie makes you think about it after you leave.
Very much so.
A lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you start to work stuff out. Cause it isn't, at first I was like, they talk about his mom. I think it was the little old ladies, right? They say that his mom, like, disappeared for an entire year and then showed back up, not even knowing she'd been gone.
That's it.
And it's like, what? what are you talking about? And then when he's in the tower and he meets his mom as a kid, as yes. that kid.
Yes.
And it makes you wonder, like in this wibbly wobbly time thing, is that his mom missing? You see what I'm saying? Like his mom went missing to help him in the future.
Yes.
Because she wants, he's like, come back with me. And she's like, I can't come back with you. I need to go back to where I belong.
To go be his mom that fulfills the timeline to get to. No, the year she's missing is her helping him out in this movie.
Yes.
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
Okay.
If just based on the loose sort of time travel premise rules that were given, I would believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're getting into Arrival and Looper territory where you have to like, you almost have to draw the diagram to, you know, those lines probably aren't going to match up if you look into it real hard. But I do think there is that factor in it.
I mean, this whole movie to me is, I was sitting there through most of it going like, what is happening? And I think that's part on purpose because I think that Mahito's going like, what is happening?
Yep.
And it gives you that feeling, probably the feeling that Miyazaki had as a kid during a war where cities are getting flattened. Like, what is happening? And it isn't until it's over that you sit there and you reflect.
It isn't until you're older and you look back on
it. Yeah, that you can start to realize, like, wow, that was a journey. Yeah, because I don't know about you, but I left the theater going like, did I like that movie? I don't know how I feel right now.
What just happened?
Yeah, it's like a what just happened.
Yep.
Which I think just shows the mastery of this man.
Absolutely.
That he gave you that feeling through drawn, moving pictures.
A cartoon.
Yes, a cartoon. He gives you that feeling of what the heck is happening. The same feeling that Mahito is going through.
Mm-hmm.
He gives you that feeling. It's masterful, really.
And it is the type of movie that somebody at the end of their career, looking back at their body of work and all that they've learned and their life as a whole, and say, what kind of story can I tell?
Right.
And it was like you were talking about earlier. It's almost like when you get really good writers or really good painters, it's like, yes, they can write a 10-book opus, but when you get to those master levels, it's like, oh, it's the economy of words, or it's the like the one paint stroke as opposed to the hundreds of paint strokes.
Right, right, right.
You know, it's that sort of thing. It's like, oh, you're doing the absolute what you needed to do to get across what you did.
Right.
And yes, it doesn't make 100% sense. You're not going to come out of that movie going, oh, this is what happened, and here's why, and blah. I have this thought about it.
Yeah.
Because it's not that type of story.
Right.
It's a Miyazaki story, which you watch it happen. You can tell the events like we're doing here on the podcast.
Right.
But it's going to be a little bit different for everybody because he makes it relatable for everybody in different points.
Right. And you can look at the Wikipedia, and there is a plot.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's so much more to it than basically, boy in city during the war goes to the countryside.
Yes.
Is having trouble dealing with his new aunt mom. She goes missing and he follows her into a fantastical world with a little help from some friends and rescues her from the world of these evil parakeet monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Deals with this crazy wizard who's in charge of the entire world.
Yeah, yeah.
And is offered to take the world over, says no, the world falls apart because of the Parakeet King, has to rescue his aunt with the help of his child mom. And, you know, there's a plot here, but there's so much more going on.
That's it.
There's so many questions that you just sit there, and he's in this dream world that also seems like purgatory because the dead are there.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-living are there. The spirits who are going to become the living are there.
Yeah. Pre-babies.
Right. There's pelicans that are trapped there that have nothing to eat because it's not the real world. How did what? Huh?
You mean displaced creatures making wrong choices in order to survive?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a human condition as told through pelicans.
Right.
And parakeets. Parakeets are at war. Why? They're adorable and fat, yeah. And I love that they will die for their parakeet king.
Yeah.
I love you, my king! But they're parakeets, you know? And like we see them and we are the god-sized beings that look at parakeets and go, you are tiny and cute.
Right.
But Miyazaki sees them as a little boy and he sees that they have been at battle because they are tribes and, you know, creatures fight, you know? Like, there's weird symbolism in there, but it's also just basic life principles too.
Right.
It's so weird.
I know there's so much going on in this. I really need to see it again to digest all of that's happening there. But really, this does seem like it's almost like, did you see the Elton John movie?
Rocket Man
that he did, which is like supposed to be an autobiography, basically.
Yeah.
But it's fantastical.
Yes.
And crazy things happen, and it's only semi-historical, and it is Elton John. It's his telling of his own story, and it's not right, but it's all him. I feel that this is the same way. This is Miyazaki telling his story. It's not exactly what happened. It's not exactly the way it went, but I see Mojito as him as a boy, and I see the wizard, Mark Hamill's character, that's him running Studio Ghibli.
Yes, that's old Miyazaki.
That's him. The tower, I think, is Studio Ghibli.
Okay.
That's what I feel.
I like it.
That he's trying to keep up. This world.
That's it.
He created a world.
It's constantly in balance.
This wizard created a world that's very difficult to keep in balance. And there's some in that world who want to destroy it.
Slice it in half with their tiny parakeet sword.
Right. I think there's a lot of going on here because he has been critical of anime.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he sees it as, and again, this might be a little pretentious, but this just is the way it is. He sees it as a high art. He treats it as a high art. He thinks all of the, you know, kawaii and the schoolgirls and all that stuff is just base.
No, there's a reason we get mythological creatures and such cultural influences when you get a Miyazaki movie.
It's almost like a classical musician might look at pop music and, you know.
Yeah, jazz to your grunge artist.
Jazz
yeah.
even.
Yeah.
You know, jazz is better than classical music, I would say.
It's about the notes you don't play.
Yeah. It's like I said, it's pretentious. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But pretentious people, Tarantino maybe. They make really good stuff.
That's it.
It happens.
Yeah.
It's just almost a quirk of artistic genius, artistic brilliance.
Especially so because, like, for all the points you're saying, like, oh, I think this is Miyazaki, I think you're right. Like, I really do think this is him telling us his story.
Right.
But all those themes, like, it's up to you to create your world. What kind of world do you want to create?
Right.
Do you want malice in your world or do you not?
Right.
Yes, that's probably old Miyazaki talking to younger Miyazaki.
Yeah, it's him talking to himself.
But it's also just, that's just life. That's a life message that anybody can listen to.
He made a movie answering the question that people always ask old people.
That's it.
What would you tell yourself if you could, you know, what would you, Mr. Miyazaki, what would you tell your childhood self?
Yeah.
And he made a movie answering that question.
And if this is him as a little boy and he did lose his mom this way, that's if you could talk to your mom again, what would you say? You know, it's that adventure. It's like that level of relationship and connection and emotion with you.
And through this, he interwove a retrospective of his films.
Absolutely.
Of his greatest movies.
That's it.
Without making it obvious, unless you really love his stuff.
Yep. Yeah, the floating rock bursting apart to become the slugs from Princess Mononoke at the end. I was like, oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it kind of also, you know, he's an old man. He's retiring. I think he spent these years thinking about retirement.
Yeah.
And it has that, like, there's no permanence.
Mm-mm.
You know, it all crumbles eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you just have to forget about it and get in the car with your new little brother, and your new mom. And because that ending is abrupt, it bothered a lot of people.
I get it.
How abrupt that ending was. But I think, again, everything is so calculated.
And here's my speculation for the intention behind what I guess people are calling abrupt. the start of the movie, for all intents as that opening fire war scene is,
yeah,
really the first like dialogue we get is Mojito saying, 2 years into the war, we evacuated the city.
Uh-huh.
And it gives you a time just to say, this is a point in my life. Mm-hmm. And it ends with saying, 3 years after the war, we returned to the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, this is a moment in my life as yeah. set up by these two statements.
Yeah.
Believe it however you want to believe it, but also this is just a slice of life.
And I love little details, just like I mentioned how in Chainsaw Man they actually animated a tie being tied.
Yes.
I noticed in that moment he's wearing the same clothes he was wearing when he got there.
Yes.
But they're significantly like there's way more ankle.
Mm-hmm.
Like he grew.
Yeah.
And I know that's such a dumb little detail, but you could forget to do that, or you could put him in different clothes. They intentionally put him in the same clothes.
I think my phone must have been hearing us have this conversation about how we like how Miyazaki pays attention, or like we love those highly detailed, unnecessary uh-huh. almost scenes. And Miyazaki is known for them because I've been fed videos of like, here's a scene from Miyazaki when she's making hats or cooking food. And you're like, man, that's so overly detailed.
Yeah.
It's great.
So sometimes we talk about fun characters that we liked. His mom is introduced to him as Lady Himi,
mm-hmm.
who is, oh man, there's so much meaning. She has fire powers.
Yes.
His mom burned in a, that's crazy. And then that's part of the, like, when she's like, she says, I'm not afraid of fire. You know, it's like, no, you can't go. And he's like, I'm not afraid of fire. I'm the fire lady. And it's like such a childlike rationalization again.
Absolutely.
Of like, oh, it's okay, my mom's the fire lady. But in the retrospective stuff, there's so much that face that they drew with her, that's Arrietty, that's, you know, Kiki, that's,
yeah,
that's that character.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The Miyazaki manic pixie dream girl almost.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, and I didn't realize this until now, it is his view of his mom, because all I can think about when his mom is the way she died.
Yeah.
As he comes to form a bond with the character before realizing it's his mom, as he forms a bond with that girl, she becomes less and less fiery and more human to him.
Uh-huh.
Like she's more often running around in that little, like, you know, little girl happy-go-lucky outfit that Miyazaki loves. But that's a thing too. Like he starts thinking of his mom again as his mom and less of like the last thing that happened, you know, which mm-hmm. is a life thing, but
right.
actually have it portrayed in that little stylistic choice.
Ooh, yeah.
Ooh, magical.
Okay. So sometimes we talk about like best fight scenes. There's not really a whole lot of that in here, but there's a lot of weird in here.
Yes.
So I want you to tell me, I'm coming up with this on the spot. I want you to tell me the weirdest moment to you,
yes,
that still has you going like, that was weird. And then I also want you to tell me the weirdest moment that you thought was awesome.
I got you.
You got it?
Well, the funny, just to lead it off, but the funniest line in this entire movie, and almost embarrassed me because I was one of the few people laughing. I don't think I was the only one, but I definitely was the loudest one. But when the door is open at the end of the movie and things are coming in and out and the parakeets start escaping and they turn back into normal parakeets. Yeah, yeah. But there's a moment where Mojito's in the door and the birds are in the door, and so it crisscrosses and his dad's looking for him. And so he thinks that Mojito turned into a parakeet.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, Mojito turned into a budgie.
Yeah.
Not only is it the British war word for parakeet, budgie. Oh, it was just, I laughed so hard. Yeah,
it was funny.
the weird what the heck is going on moment for me, that I'll say this for both, because actually this sort of was the moment that clicked in it for me.
Oh.
Like I said, this is childhood magical thinking media.
Mm-hmm.
This lane is my bread and butter. I could watch it all day. But when he goes and finally sees his mom in the dream world,
uh-huh.
the deal has been made. Birdman says, here's your mother. I brought you to her.
Mm-hmm.
Weird Robert Pattinson, you did such a great job. He goes to touch her and she melts.
Yeah.
And it's just a puddle. And that
was so Ghibli too.
That was Ghibli. That's weird. Like because when he does liquid effects or mutations, it's always almost too grotesque.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. It's like the Howl's Moving Castle, those those evil guys.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when the like when the dragon's transforming, it almost looks painful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Chainsaw Man does that too. Like,
right.
It's very artistic and in the poetic in the way that they do it. But that was just such a dreamlike quality to let me know. It's like, oh, we're in a dream world as seen from a childlike dreaming brain, mm-hmm. trying to rationalize the unknown around him. And that was sort of the scene that just sort of like solidified it all for me. And like the fact that the deal was undone because of the loophole of words. It's like dealing with the fae. You're in a fairy tale.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
That's fairy land, and fae land, yes, is magical as a child, but fae land also has larger connotations and mm-hmm. complications to it.
Yeah.
And that's what Miyazaki loves tapping into. And that was a weird scene that I was like, oh yeah, now we're kind of getting it.
I like how you added the funny scene, because the funniest scene that made me laugh
yeah.
is when so apparently this guy's called Birdman. It's funny because these creatures have names that you don't, they're never said in
Wada
the
Wada.
Movie.
Yeah.
Well, Wada Wada's there, but he was just the heron, but I guess he was the Birdman is what he was. But the funniest scene to me is when he's fixing the hole in his beak. And there's, so like he fixes the hole and he's like, ah, it's making me go cross eyed. He's like, can you? And then they just keep going back and forth. It goes on for way too long.
Yeah.
Which is what comedy is.
Yeah.
It goes on for way too long. I'm just adjusting it with his little knife.
It's like, well, actually, it sticks out a little bit. Could you just, and then they cut to that one shot of them like by the tree. And it's,
yeah, I know.
Like no dialogue. It's just them working on it. Yeah. And they cut to that one scene probably about three or four times. Yeah. No, that's awesome.
It was very funny. The weirdest weird to me, and it had a point, but it was so disturbing, was what's called in the credits, the noble pelican, William Dafoe's burned, dying pelican.
That's it.
It was so gross.
Yeah.
And so weird.
Yep.
And he's explaining, like, you know, I know you think it's horrible that we're eating these pre-babies or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, we have to because we're an invasive species and we have nothing else to eat. And I was just like going, what is going on? This is so weird. He is so gross. What is happening? And I'm like, you're saying all kinds of things, Miyazaki. I know you're saying all kinds of things here.
Yeah.
But this is freaking me out, man.
Yeah, no, it's very weird in an already weird setting. Because that scene where fully, like, he's on the underside, like, fully and completely. And we kind of know the rules. And then that just makes it a little bit weirder. Like,
yeah.
Oh, there's like, it's not just a hive mind of pelicans. My guess, if you want it, is that's Miyazaki taking a moment to do what he loves to do, and that's his commentary on war.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Mahito came across some person in his village that was wounded, injured, maybe a soldier from the other side, maybe a soldier from his side, I don't know. But it's like some adult was giving him explanations for why all the craziness is going on, right. And he was just hearing words like,
yeah.
Okay, you're here and you need to do this because of reasons. Like, that's almost, you know, pick a war and that's almost the justification for any of it, you know?
Right.
I think that's sort of the stand-in for the noble pelican.
Oh, he just had it with birds, right?
Obviously, there's probably is some, like, more Japanese cultural lore reason for birds because, like you said, a heron is a iconic creature mm-hmm. in manuscripts and stuff. But no, I also really do think this also, like, Miyazaki just hates birds.
Yeah.
If there's an interview out there, I would like you to send it to me. I will go looking for it, but that's my hot take. Miyazaki hates birds.
The parakeets, the whole thing was that was hilarious too. They're all cannibalistic.
Yep.
We keep talking about Spirited Away cause that happens in the spirit world too. Yep. But just the parakeets and their whole little parakeet castle or whatever they were in
mm-hmm.
was just so Spirited Away.
Oh, absolutely.
Like very much so,
mm-hmm.
but hilarious. You're right. And that thing where, you know, he's like, I must go on my own. And you said earlier when like, we love you. I've seen that in so many animes
mm-hmm.
and things that he's done.
Yeah.
That's like stuff that's like stuff from Porco Rosso and stuff. You know, the group gathered around and weird shouting out in the middle. That's he's just doing a victory lap, man. I'm telling you.
Oh, and you can tell that the whoever was in that walla room, the walla for this movie must have been amazing. Just all those bird sounds, and they were still talking and using words. Like they start taking out parakeets by knocking them over the head, but instead of yelling out like humans, they make little squeaks like parakeets do. So he clangs one with a frying pan, and it just goes, oh, that's so funny.
And those two that go with the king, and they have his mom in a Sleeping Beauty, or
or
Snow White, both. They were both in those glass cases.
Mm-hmm.
Again, reference. But when they enter that, they're following him around. They're so distracted. It's very funny.
I've never been out here before. Yeah. Is this paradise? Just because it has fruit and trees. Oh, magical.
Oh, man.
Well, now here comes the hard part, though. For all the questions that we still have and answers that we don't have, we get to still have to make a decision and rate it, though.
Is our pizza here, Mikey?
Our pizza is here.
Oh.
Brought to us by parakeets. They look real mad. We should tip them.
For those newer listeners, whenever we do assumptions, which are reviews of things, we have a rating system based on pizza, because pizza is terrific.
That's it.
Instead of a 1 through 10 or 5 stars, we do 8 slices of pizza, which is a typical cut up pizza amount.
That's it.
8, of course, being best, 1 being the worst, and then we can goose it with toppings and delivery methods and places it came from and sides, and it's very arbitrary. It is sometimes as weird and confusing as The Boy and the Heron is.
Yes. The Boy and the Heron, also The Boy and His Pizza. So
Mikey, out of 8 slices of pizza, what do you give Miyazaki's Boy and the Heron?
I tried not to telegraph this from the start of this podcast, but I did a terrible job of it. I love this movie. I give this is an 8 slicer topped with mozzarella sticks, 13-year-old me's favorite treat. This is a mozzarella stick topped pizza, handmade by somebody that loves me. No, this is everything I didn't know I was going to get and didn't know I needed from a Miyazaki masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, the Book of Strange Things, when it influenced, there's a Neil Gaiman book called The Ocean at the End of the Lane. We referenced Labyrinth, Empire of the Sun. This is also Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah.
This is Alice in Wonderland. I mean, that was C.S. Lewis. That was his magnum opus.
Right.
And it's a classic.
Mm.
This is, I would say, just the same amount of well-crafted story with the same amount of personal life. Because there's so much of Miyazaki's life in here.
Yep.
Like, the touchstones and everything, but also, like, his life lesson.
Like you said, it's very personal.
Yeah. This is your grandpa sitting you down and saying, let me tell you the story about everything I've learned in life. And you're like, holy crap, let me get my notebook.
Yeah.
This is Miyazaki doing this, I think.
Right.
And it was weird. There's a lot of questions I have about it.
Yeah.
But none of it was a missed beat for me.
Mm-hmm.
So 8 out of 8 slices, topped with mozzarella sticks.
Wow.
Made by Chef Boyardee. He loves me.
Chef Boyardee. No, I don't. Yeah, I don't know if I hit it much. For me, this truly is, and I'm not bandwagoning here, this is a masterpiece of an animated movie. We've always loved Miyazaki, but it is very weird, and it did throw me off, and it did slightly disturb me, and I left not knowing if I liked it or not. And is one of those things, like when I saw some of the like Star Wars thing, the prequels and stuff, I was like, I think I like it. Uh-huh. Do I not? You know, it just gives you this off-put feeling, but I can see the mastery in it. It's almost like seeing a piece of art that you fully don't understand, but you know it's masterful.
Yeah.
And it was made by a master. So I'm giving it 8 slices, but this is 8 slices of like a Michelin chef's pizza.
Yep.
It's like super fancy or not, if that's what he's going for. I'm not sure, but I'm sitting here and I'm like going, I know this pizza is like one of the best pizzas in the world.
Yeah.
I can tell. But at the same time, there's some really weird toppings on here that I don't get why are on a pizza.
What am I chewing on right now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it tastes really good.
You put fig and goat cheese on here?
It is. Yeah. It's and that's how it comes across to me. This is 8 slices of cream, but the toppings are crazy, like fusion of things that I don't understand, but it tastes so good, and I really enjoy it. But at the same time, I'm like, is this going to give me heartburn later? I'm not sure, but it's worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You may still need to grab a slice of something else on the way home.
No. Yeah.
No, I'm with you. I agree that this is, you were right in calling it condensed Miyazaki, because this is also one I can see myself rewatching around the house the most.
Yeah.
Because, like, it is such a perfectly encapsulated story.
Yeah.
For what it is, it's just such a slice of life that is all a perfect balance of Miyazaki having fun with creatures and Miyazaki telling life stories. That I do think there's, just as a whole, it is like condensed Miyazaki,
right?
Efficient Miyazaki.
It's eminently rewatchable, I think, is what it is. And I guess that's why I put it up there with some of his greatest other movies that are really rewatchable.
Yep.
Because you always find something new or get further insight with the Howls, the Spirited Aways that we keep mentioning, because those are some of his more complicated ones. There are other ones like that are great. One of my favorite movies of his ever is Arrietty, and that's super simple.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not anything weird really at all that happens in there. It's pretty straightforward.
Just cozy and comfy.
Yeah, which is nice to know that when a guy can do something like that, doing something like this has even more weight.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not just the guy who always does weird stuff.
Yep, for sure.
Which is something that happens in art.
Yeah.
And then you start to go like, do you know how to actually do something that's not weird?
You could almost call that the Tim Burton argument.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Oh, wow. 8 slices from both of us.
Yeah, yeah. With different toppings. I love it.
You guys know what we think. We want to know what you think. Are you in agreement with, seems like most everyone, that this is a magnum opus of Miyazaki? Let us know. You can hit us up on the social medias at Assuming Pod. That's Facebook and Instagram and X, Twitter, and Threads. You can also send us a Gmail, assumingpositions@gmail.com. Hey, Mikey, how would you like the Gmail formatted?
Delivered by bird.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, strap it to a pigeon, send it my way, and scare me.
Did you notice how he would make the birds poop on people?
Poop was a factor.
Yeah, there was a lot of bird poop.
I could do a treatise on that, too. Miyazaki has a weird fascination with the beauty in the grossness of life.
Yes.
And I think that is part of that, the bird poop. Especially since they, like, the first bird poop that happens, they make it real audible, but they don't show it till after the fact because they know you're waiting to see it. Like, did that bird just poop? And then 2 scenes later, you're like, oh, that bird did just poop.
Oh, yes. Deliver it by some kind of bird.
Yes. Just don't let me know beforehand. It'll scare the crap out of me.
If you guys like what we do here on the podcast, podcasting is not free. We would really appreciate you throwing some ducats our way. You can do that by going to buymeacoffee.com/assumingpod. Mm-hmm. And we want to thank you guys so much for listening. You're the best positrons any podcast could ever have. Keep positive. We also want to thank That Guy Brad for doing our announcing, Not Scott Productions for our equipment and being our producer. Then Jazzar for our music. We hope you guys have a great rest of your week. Go ahead and see this movie. We highly recommend it.
Yeah, go watch it a whole bunch.
How do you live? Oh, yeah, how do you live?
Watch out for the heron.